Even shorn of her layers of protective clothing, Lady Sybil Ramkin was still toweringly big. Vimes knew that the barbarian Hublander folk had legends about great chain-mailed, armor-bra'd, cart-horse-riding maidens who swooped down on battlefields and carried off dead warriors on their crupper to a glorious roistering afterlife while singing in a pleasing mezzo-soprano. Lady Ramkin could have been one of them. She could have led them. She could have carried off a battalion. When she spoke, every word was like a hearty slap on the back and clanged with the aristocratic self-assurance of the totally well-bred. The vowel sounds alone would have cut teak. Vimes's ragged forebears were used to voices like that, usually from heavily armoured people on the back of a war charger, telling them why it would be a jolly good idea, don't you know, to charge the enemy and hit them for six. His legs wanted to stand to attention. Prehistoric men would have worshipped her, and in fact had amazingly managed to carve lifelike statues of her thousands of years ago. She had a mass of chestnut hair. A wig, Vimes learned later. No one who had much to do with dragons kept their own hair for long. She also had a dragon on her shoulder. It had been introduced as Talonthrust Vincent Wonderkind of Quirm, referred to as Vinny, and seemed to be making a large contribution to the unusual chemical smell that pervaded the house. This smell permeated everything. Even the generous slice of cake she offered him tasted of it.
The shoulder, it looks, very nice, he said, desperate to make conversation.
Rubbish, said her ladyship. I'm just training him up because shoulder sitters fetch twice the price. Vimes murmured that he had occasionally seen society ladies with small, colourful dragons on their shoulders, and thought it looked very nice.
It sounds nice, she said, I'll grant you. Then they realise it means soot burns, frizzled hair and crapple down their back. Those talons dig in too, and then they think the thing's getting too big and smelly, and the next thing you know it's either down to the Moorpork Sunshine Sanctuary for lost dragons, or the old heave-ho into the river with a rope around your neck, poor little buggers.
She sat down, arranging a skirt that could have made sails for a small fleet.
Now then, Captain Vimes, was it?
Vimes was at a loss. Ramkins, long dead, stared down at him from ornate frames high on the shadowy walls. Between, around, and under the portraits were the weapons they'd presumably used, and had used well and often by the look of them. Suits of armour stood in dented ranks along the walls. Quite a number, he couldn't help noticing, had large holes in them. The ceiling was a faded riot of moth-eaten banners. You did not need forensic examination to understand that Lady Ramkin's ancestors had never shirked a fight. It was amazing that she was capable of doing something so unwarlike as having a cup of tea.
"My forebears," she said, following his hypnotised gaze. You know, not one Ramkin in the last 1,000 years has died in his bed.
Yes, ma'am.
Source of family pride, that.
Yes, ma'am.
Quite a few of them have died in other people's, of course.
Captain Vimes's teacup rattled in its saucer.
Yes, ma'am, he said. Captain is such a dashing title, I've always thought.
She gave him a bright, brittle smile.
I mean, colonels and so on are always so stuffy. Majors are pompous, but one always feels somehow that there is something delightfully dangerous about a captain. What was it you had to show me?
Vimes gripped his parcel like a chastity belt.
I wondered, he faltered, how big swamp...
He stopped. Something dreadful was happening to his lower regions. Lady Ramkin followed his gaze.
"Oh, take no notice of him," she said cheerfully. "Hit him with a cushion if he's a bother."
A small, elderly dragon had crawled out from under his chair and placed its jowly muzzle in Vimes's lap. It stared up at him soulfully with big brown eyes and gently dribbled something quite corrosive by the feel of it over his knees. And it stank like the ring around an acid bath.
"That's Dewdrop Maybelline Talonthrust the First," said her ladyship. "Champion and sire of champions. No fire left now, poor soppy old thing. He likes his belly rubbed."
Vimes made surreptitiously vicious jerking motions to dislodge the old dragon. It blinked mournfully at him with rheumy eyes, and rolled back the corner of its mouth, exposing a picket fence of soot-blackened teeth.
"Just push him off if he's a nuisance," said Lady Ramkin cheerfully. "Now then, what was it you were asking?"
"I was wondering how big swamp dragons grow," said Vimes, trying to shift position. There was a faint growling noise.
"You came all the way up here to ask me that? Well, I seem to recall Gayheart Talonthrust of Ankh stood 14 thumbs high, toe to matlock," mused Lady Ramkin.
About
3 foot 6 inches, she added kindly.
"No bigger than that," said Vimes hopefully.
In his lap the old dragon began to snore gently.
"Golly, no. He was a bit of a freak, actually. Mostly they don't get much bigger than 8 thumbs.
Captain Vimes's lips moved in a hurried calculation.
2 feet, he ventured.
"Well done!
That's the cobs, of course. The hens are a bit smaller." Captain Vimes wasn't going to give in.
"A cob would be a male dragon," he said.
"Only after the age of 2 years," said Lady Ramkin triumphantly. "Up to the age of 8 months he's a pumet. Then he's a cock until 14 months, and then he's a snood."
Captain Vimes sat entranced, eating the horrible cake, breeches gradually dissolving as the stream of information flooded over him. How the males fought with flame, but in the laying season only the hens breathed fire. Only until their third clutch, of course, after that their dams. From the combustion of complex intestinal gases to incubate the eggs which needed such a fierce temperature while the males gathered firewood. A group of swamp dragons was a slump, or an embarrassment. A female was capable of laying up to 3 clutches of 4 eggs every year, most of which were trodden on by an absent-minded male, and that dragons of both sexes were vaguely uninterested in one another, and indeed everything except firewood, except for about once every 2 months, when they became as single-minded as a buzzsaw. He was helpless to prevent himself being taken out of the kennels at the back, outfitted from neck to ankle in leather armour faced with steel plates, and ushered into the long, low building where the whistling had come from. The temperature was terrible, but not as bad as the cocktail of smells. He staggered aimlessly from one metal-lined pen to another, while pear-shaped, squeaking little horrors with red eyes were introduced as Moonpenny Duchess Marchpane, who's gravid at the moment, and Moonmist Talonthrust the Second, who was best of breed at Pseudopolis last year. Jets of pale green flame played across his knees. Many of the stalls had rosettes and certificates pinned over them. "And this one, I'm afraid, is good boy Bindle Featherstone of Quirm," said Lady Ramkin, relentlessly. Vimes stared groggily over the charred barrier at the small creature curled up in the middle of the floor. It bore about the same resemblance to the rest of them as Nobby did to the average human being. Something in its ancestry had given it a pair of eyebrows that were about the same size as its stubby wings, which could never have supported it in the air. Its head was the wrong shape, like an anteater. It had nostrils like jet intakes. If it ever managed to get airborne, the things would have the drag of twin parachutes. It was also turning on Captain Vimes the most silently intelligent look he'd ever had from any animal, including Corporal Nobbs.
"It happens," said Lady Ramkins, sadly. "It's all down to genes, you know."
"It is," said Vimes.
Somehow the creature seemed to be concentrating all the power its siblings wasted in flame and noise into a stare like a thermic lance. He couldn't help remembering how much he'd wanted a puppy when he was a little boy. Mind you, they'd been starving. Anything with meat on it would have done. He heard the dragon lady say,
"One tries to breed for a good flame, depth of scale, correct colour, and so on. One just has to put up with the occasional total whittle."
The little dragon turned on Vimes a gaze that would be guaranteed to win it the award for dragon the judges would be most likely to take home and use as a portable gaslighter. Total whittle, Vimes thought. He wasn't sure of the precise meaning of the word, but he could hazard a shrewd guess. It sounded like whatever it was you had left when you had extracted everything of any value whatsoever. Like the watch, he thought. Total whittles, every one of them. And just like him, it was the saga of his life.
"That's nature for you,"
said her ladyship. "Of course I wouldn't dream of breeding from him, but he wouldn't be able to anyway."
"Why not?" said Vimes.
"Because dragons have to mate in the air, and he'll never be able to fly with those wings, I'm afraid. I'll be sorry to lose the bloodline, naturally. His sire was Brenda Rodley's tree-bite Brightscale. Do you know Brenda?"
No, said Vimes.
Lady Ramkin was one of those people who assumed that everyone else knew everyone one knew.
Charming girl. Anyway, his brothers and sisters are shaping up very well.
Poor little bastard, thought Vimes. That's nature for you in a nutshell. Always dealing off the bottom of the pack. No wonder they call her a mother.
You said you had something to show me, Lady Ramkin prompted.
Vimes wordlessly handed her the parcel. She slipped off her heavy mittens and unwrapped it.
"Plaster cast of a footprint," she said baldly.
"Well?"
"Does it remind you of anything?" said Vimes.
"Could be a wading bird."
"Oh," Vimes was crestfallen. Lady Ramkin laughed. "Or a really big dragon. Got it out of a museum, did you?"
"No. I got it off the street this morning."
"Ha! Someone's been playing tricks on you, old chap."
There was, circumstantial evidence," he told her. She stared at him.
"Draco Nobilis," she said hoarsely.
"Pardon," said Vimes.
"Draco Nobilis, the noble dragon,
as opposed to these fellows." She waved a hand in the direction of the massed ranks of whistling lizards.
"Draco vulgaris, the lot of them. But the big ones are all gone, you know. This really is a nonsense. No two ways about it. All gone. Beautiful things they were. Weighed tons. Biggest things ever to fly. No one knows how they did it."
And then they realized. It was suddenly very quiet. All along the rows of kennels the dragons were silent, bright-eyed and watchful. They were staring at the roof. Carrot looked around him. Shelves stretched away in every direction. On those shelves, books. He made a calculated guess.
"This is the library, isn't it?" he said.
The librarian maintained his gentle but firm grip on the boy's hand and led him along the maze of aisles.
"Is there a body?" said Carrot.
"There'd have to be.
Worse than murder. A body in a library. It could lead to anything."
The ape eventually padded to a halt in front of a shelf no different than, it seemed, 100 others. Some of the books were chained up. There was a gap. The librarian pointed to it.
"Ooh!
Well, what about it? A hole where a book should be."
"Ooh!
A book has been taken."
"A book has been taken?
You summoned the watch?" Carrot drew himself up proudly. "Because someone's taken a book? You think that's worse than murder?" The librarian gave him the kind of look other people would reserve for people who said things like, "What's so bad about genocide?"
"This is practically a criminal offence, wasting watch time," said Carrot. "Why don't you just tell the head wizards or whoever they are?"
"Ook!" The librarian indicated with some surprisingly economical gestures that most wizards would not find their own bottoms with both hands.
"Well, I don't see what we can do about it," said Carrot. "What's the book called?"
The librarian scratched his head. This one was going to be tricky. He faced Carrot, put his leather glove hands together, then folded them open.
"I know it's a book. What's its name?"
The librarian sighed and held up a hand.
"Four words," said Carrot.
"First word." The ape pinched two wrinkled fingers together.
"Small word. A. The
The?
The.
Second word.
Third word.
Small word.
The
A.
To.
Of.
From.
Of.
Of.
The something of something. Second word.
What?
Oh. First syllable.
Fingers. Touching your fingers. Thumbs."
The orangutan growled and tugged theatrically at one large hairy ear.
"Oh,
Sounds like fingers. Hand. Adding up. Sums. Cut off. Smaller word, smaller word, smaller word. Some. Second syllable, small, very small syllable. A, in, un, on, some. Some on. The summoner. Summoning. Summoning. The summoning of something. Oh, this is fun, isn't it? Fourth word, whole word. He peered intently as the librarian gyrated mysteriously. Big thing. Huge big thing. Flapping. Great big flapping leaping thing. Teeth. Huffing, blowing. Great big huge blowing flapping thing. Sweat broke out on Carrot's forehead as he tried obediently to understand. Sucking fingers. Sucking fingers thing. Burnt. Hot. Great big hot blowing flapping thing. The librarian rolled his eyes. Homo sapiens, you could keep it. The great dragon danced and spun and trod the air over the city. Its colour was moonlight gleaming off its scales. Sometimes it would twist and glide with deceptive speed over the rooftops for the sheer joy of existing. And it was all wrong, Vimes thought. Part of him was marvelling at the sheer beauty of the sight, but an insistent, weaselly little group of brain cells from the wrong side of the synapses was scrawling its graffiti on the walls of wonderment. "It's a bloody great lizard," they jeered. "Must weigh tons. Nothing that big can fly, not even on beautiful wings. And what is a flying lizard doing with great big scales on its back?" 500 feet above him, a lance of blue-white flame roared into the sky. "It can't do something like that. It'd burn its own lips off." Beside him, Lady Ramkin stood with her mouth open. Behind her, the little caged dragons yammered and howled. The great beast turned in the air and swooped over the rooftops. The flame darted out again. Below it, yellow flames sprang up. It was done so quietly and stylishly that it took Vimes several seconds to realize that several buildings had in fact been set on fire. "Golly," said Lady Ramkin, "look, it's using the thermals. That's what the fire is for." She turned to Vimes, her eyes hopelessly aglow. "Do you realize we're very probably seeing something that no one else has seen for centuries?" "Yes, it's a bloody flying alligator setting fire to my city," shouted Vimes. She wasn't listening to him. "There must be a breeding colony somewhere," she said. "After all this time, where do you think it lives?" Vimes didn't know, but he swore to himself that he would find out and ask it some very serious questions. "One egg," breathed the breeder. "Just let me get my hands on one egg." Vimes stared at her in genuine astonishment. It dawned on him that he was very probably a flawed character. Below them, another building exploded into flame. "How far exactly," he said, speaking very slowly and carefully as to a child, "did these things fly?" "Oh, they're very territorial animals," murmured her ladyship. "According to legend, they..." Vimes realized he was in for another dose of dragon lore. "Just give me the facts, m'lady," he said impatiently. "Not very far, really," she said, slightly taken aback. "Thank you very much, ma'am. You've been very helpful," muttered Vimes, and broke into a run. Somewhere in the city. There was nothing outside for miles except low fields and swamp. It had to be living somewhere in the city. His sandals flapped on the cobbles as he hurtled down the streets. Somewhere in the city, which was totally ridiculous, of course. Totally ridiculous and impossible. He didn't deserve this. Of all the cities in all the world it could have flown to, he thought, it's flown into mine. By the time he reached the river, the dragon had vanished. But a pall of smoke was hanging over the streets, and several human bucket chains had been formed to pass lumps of the river to the stricken buildings. The Guild of Firefighters had been outlawed by the patrician the previous year, after many complaints. The point was that if you bought a contract from the Guild, your house would be protected against fire. Unfortunately, the general Ankh-Morpork ethos quickly came to the fore, and firefighters would tend to go to prospective clients' houses in groups, making loud comments like, "Very inflammable-looking place, this," and "Probably go up like a firework with just one carelessly dropped match. Know what I mean?" The job was considerably hampered by the droves of people streaming out of the streets carrying their possessions. Most of the city was wood and thatch, and they weren't taking any chances. In fact, the danger was surprisingly small, mysteriously small when you came to think about it. Vimes had surreptitiously taken to carrying a notebook these days, and he had noted the damage as if the mere act of writing it down somehow made the world a more understandable place. Item. A coach house belonging to an inoffensive businessman who'd seen his new carriage go up in flames. Item. A small vegetable shop with pinpoint accuracy. Vimes wondered about that. He'd bought some apples in there once, and there didn't appear to be anything about it that a dragon could possibly take offence at. Still, very considerate of the dragon, he thought, as he made his way to the watch-house. When you think of all the timber yards, hay ricks, thatched roofs and oil stores it could have hit by chance, it's managed to really frighten everyone without actually harming the city. Rays of early morning sunlight were piercing the drifts of smoke as he pushed open the door. This was home. Not the bare little room over the candlemaker's shop in Wixon's Alley where he slept, but this nasty brown room that smelt of unswept chimneys, Sergeant Colan's pipe, Nobby's mysterious personal problem, and latterly, Carrot's armour polish. It was almost like home. No one else was there. He wasn't entirely surprised. He clumped up to his office and leaned back in his chair, whose cushion would have been thrown out of its basket in disgust by an incontinent dog, pulled his helmet over his eyes, and tried to think. No good rushing about. The dragon had vanished in all the smoke and confusion, as suddenly as it had come. Time for rushing about soon enough. The important thing was working out where to rush to. He'd been right. Wading bird. But where did you start looking for a bloody great dragon in a city of 1 million people? He was aware that his right hand, entirely unbidden, had pulled open the bottom drawer, and three of his fingers, acting on sealed orders from his hindbrain, had lifted out a bottle. It was one of those bottles that emptied themselves. Reason told him that sometimes he must occasionally start one, break the seal, see amber liquid glistening all the way up to the neck. It was just that he couldn't remember the sensation. It was as if the bottles arrived two-thirds empty. He stared at the label. It seemed to be Jimkin Bearhugger's old selected dragon's blood whiskey. Cheap and powerful. You could light fires with it. You could clean spoons. You didn't have to drink much of it to be drunk, which was just as well. It was Nobby who shook him awake with the news that there was a dragon in the city, and also that Sergeant Colon had had a nasty turn. Vimes sat and blinked owlishly while the words washed around him. Apparently, having a fire-breathing lizard focusing interestedly on one's nether regions from a distance of a few feet can upset the strongest constitution. An experience like that could leave a lasting mark on a person. Vimes was still digesting this when Carrot turned up with the librarian swinging along behind him. "Did you see it? Did you see it?" he said. "We all saw it," said Vimes. "I know all about it," said Carrot triumphantly. "Someone's brought it here with magic. Someone's stolen a book out of the library, and guess what it's called?"
"Can't even begin to," said Vimes weakly. "It's called The Summoning of Dragons."
"Ooh," confirmed the librarian.
"Oh, what's it about?" said Vimes.
The librarian rolled his eyes.
"It's about how to summon dragons by magic."
"Ooh."
"And that's illegal, that is," said Carrot happily. "Releasing feral creatures upon the streets, contrary to the wild animals, brackets public."
Vimes groaned. That meant wizards. You got nothing but trouble with wizards.
"I suppose," he said, "there wouldn't be another copy of this book around, would there?"
"Ooh."
The librarian shook his head.
"And you wouldn't happen to know what's in it?"
Vimes sighed.
"What?"
"Oh, four words," he said wearily. "First word sounds like bend. Bow, sow, cow, how, how, how. Second word, small word, the A to two, two. Yes, understood, but I'm meant in any kind of detail."
"No, I see."
"What are we going to do now, sir?" said Carrot anxiously.
"It's out there,"
intoned Nobby. "Gone to ground, like, during the hours of daylight, coiled up in its secret lair, on top of a great hoard of gold, dreaming ancient reptilian dreams from a dawn of time, waiting for the secret curtains of the night, when once more it will sally forth." He hesitated and added sullenly, "What you all looking at me like that for?"
"Very poetic," said Carrot.
"Well, everyone knows the real old dragons used to go to sleep on a hoard of gold," said Nobby. "Well-known folk myth."
Vimes looked blankly into the immediate future. Vile though Nobby was, he was also a good indication of what was going through the mind of the average citizen. You could use him as a sort of laboratory rat to forecast what was going to happen next.
"I expect you'd be really interested in finding out where that hoard is, wouldn't you?" said Vimes experimentally.
Nobby looked even more shifty than usual.
"Well, Captain, I was thinking of having a bit of a look around, you know, when I'm off duty, of course," he added virtuously.
"Oh, dear," said Captain Vimes.
He lifted up the empty bottle with great care and put it back in the drawer. The elucidated brethren were nervous. A kind of fear crackled from brother to brother. It was the fear of someone who, having cheerfully experimented with pouring the powder and wadding the ball, has found that pulling the trigger had led to a god-awful bang, and pretty soon someone is bound to come and see who's making all the noise. The Supreme Grand Master knew that he had them, though. Sheep and lamb, sheep and lamb. Since they couldn't do anything much worse than they had already done, they might as well press on and damn the world, and pretend they'd wanted it like this all along. Ugh. The joy of it. Only Brother Plasterer was actually happy.
"Let that be a lesson to all oppressive vegetable sellers," he kept saying.
"Yes, said Brother Doorkeeper, "only the thing is, there's no chance of us sort of accidentally summoning the dragon here, is there?"
"Aye, that is, we have it under perfect control," said the Supreme Grand Master smoothly. "The power is ours, I can assure you."
The brothers cheered up a little bit. "And now," the Supreme Grand Master continued, "there is the matter of the king." The brothers looked solemn, except for Brother Plasterer.
"Have we found him, then?" he said. "That's a stroke of luck."
"You never listen, do you?" snapped Brother Watchtower. "It was all explained last week. We don't go around finding anyone. We make a king."
"I thought he was supposed to turn up because of destiny,"
Brother Watchtower sniggered.
"We sort of help destiny along a bit."
The Supreme Grand Master smiled in the depths of his robe. It was amazing, this mystic business. You tell them a lie, and then when you don't need it any more, you tell them another lie, and tell them they're progressing along the road to wisdom. Then instead of laughing, they follow you even more, hoping that at the heart of all the lies they'll find the truth. And bit by bit, they accept the unacceptable. Amazing.
"Bloody hell, that's clever," said Brother Doorkeeper. "How do we do that, then?"
"Look, the Supreme Grand Master said what we do. We find some handsome lad who's good at taking orders. He kills the dragon, and Bob's your uncle. Simple, much more intelligent than waiting for a so-called real king."
"But," Brother Plasterer seemed deep in the toils of celebration, "if we control the dragon, and we do control the dragon, right, then we don't need anyone killing it. We just stop summoning it, and everyone'll be happy, right?"
"Oh, yes," said Brother Watchtower nastily. "I can just see it, can't you? We just trot out and say, 'Hello, we won't set fire to your houses any more. Aren't we nice, do we? The whole point about the thing with the king is that he'll be a sort of,
undeniably potent and romantic symbol of absolute authority," said the Supreme Grand Master smoothly.
"That's it," said Brother Watchtower. "A potent authority."
"Oh, I see," said Brother Plasterer. "Right. Okay. That's what the king'll be."
"That's it," said Brother Watchtower.
"No one going to argue with a potent authority, are they?"
"Too right,"
said Brother Watchtower.
"Stroke of luck, then, finding the true king right now," said Brother Plasterer. "Million to one chance, really."
"We haven't found the right king. We don't need the right king," said the Supreme Grand Master wearily. "For the last time, I've just found us a likely lad who looks good in a crown and can take orders and knows how to flourish a sword. Now, just listen." Flourishing, of course, was important. It didn't have much to do with wielding. Wielding a sword, the Supreme Grand Master considered, was simply the messy business of dynastic surgery. It was just a matter of thrust and cut. Whereas a king had to flourish one. It had to catch the light in just the right way, leaving watchers in no doubt that here was destiny's chosen. He'd taken a long time preparing the sword and shield. It had been very expensive. The shield shone like a dollar in a sweep's ear hole, but the sword was magnificent. It was long and shiny. It looked like something some genius of metalwork, one of those little Zen guys who works only by the light of dawn and can beat a club sandwich of folded steels into something with the cutting edge of a scalpel and the stopping power of a sex-crazed rhinoceros on bad acid, had made and then retired in tears because he'd never, ever do anything so good again. There were so many jewels on the hilt, it had to be sheathed in velvet. You had to look at it through smoked glass. Just laying a hand on it practically conferred kingship. As for the lad, he was a distant cousin, keen and vain and stupid in a passably aristocratic way. Currently he was under guard in a distant farmhouse with an adequate supply of drink and several young ladies, although what the boy seemed most interested in was mirrors. Probably hero material, the Supreme Grand Master thought glumly.
"I suppose," said Brother Watchtower, "that he isn't the real heir to the throne."
"What do you mean?" said the Supreme Grand Master.
"Well, you know how it is. Fate plays funny tricks." "It'd be a laugh, wouldn't it," said Brother Watchtower, "if this lad turned out to be the real king, after all this trouble?"
"There is no real king any more," snapped the Supreme Grand Master. "What do you expect? Some people wandering in the wilderness for hundreds and hundreds of years, patiently handing down a sword and a birthmark? Some sort of magic?"
He spat the word. "He'd make use of magic. Means to an end. End justifies means, and so forth. But to go around believing it had some sort of moral force, like logic, made him wince.
Good grief, man, be logical. Be rational. Even if any of the old royal family survived, the bloodline would be so watered down by now that there must be thousands of people who lay claim to the throne. Even," he tried to think of the least likely claimant, "even someone like Brother Dunnikin."
He stared at the assembled brethren.
"Don't see him here tonight, by the way."
"Funny thing, that," said Brother Watchtower thoughtfully. "Didn't you hear?"
"What?"
"He got bitten by a crocodile on his way home last night. Poor little bugger."
"What?"
"Million to one chance. It had escaped from a menagerie or something and was lying low in his backyard. He went to feel under his doormat for his door key, and it had him by the funes."
A species of geranium.
Brother Watchtower fumbled under his robe and produced a grubby brown envelope. "We're having a whip round to buy him some grapes and that. I don't know whether you'd like to,
"Put me down for $3, said the Supreme Grand Master.
Brother Watchtower nodded. "Funny thing," he said, "I already have."
"Just a few more nights," thought the Supreme Grand Master. "By tomorrow the people'll be so desperate they'd crown even a one-legged troll if he got rid of the dragon. And we'll have a king, and he'll have an adviser, a trusted man, of course, and this stupid rabble can go back to the gutter. No more dressing up, no more ritual, no more summoning the dragon. I can give it up," he thought. "I can give it up any time I like.